Today's Taisho will be on Case 39 in the Heikigan Roku. Case 39 is entitled Uman's Kaya Kuran. Engo's introduction. When one is enlightened and enjoys perfect freedom of mind in ordinary life, one is like a tiger that commands its mountain retreat. If one is not enlightened and drifts about in the affairs of the world, one is like a monkey in a cage. If you want to know Buddha nature, you must pay attention to time and causation. If you aspire to the condition of pure gold that has been refined 100 times over, you must be shaped in the teacher's forge. I want to ask you this: how would you identify the one who has mastered the way of the absolute? Main subject: a monk asked Uman, what is the pure body of the Buddha? Uman said, Kaya Kuran, which is a fence around a flower garden. The monk said, how about if I understand it like that? Uman said, the golden-haired lion. Secho's verse, don't mistake Kaya Kuran. The mark is on the balance, not the tray. Saying like that betrays ignorance. Master hand, beware the golden lion. So it's day two of our sesshin, of our January sesshin, and everybody is, of course, sitting very well. You know, people here have done sesshin before and very practiced, and it's, you know, basically wonderful to sit with people who are so determined and practice so wholeheartedly. It's really wonderful. But, you know, even if you practice for a long time, I think everybody goes through a kind of process at sesshin. And even people who are very adept, you know, when you come to sesshin, I sometimes think it's not just a matter of people being caught up in the affairs of the world, although it's certainly true. You know, it's definitely the case that on the first day of a sesshin, you know, people are still thinking about problems at home. They're still thinking about issues in their job or, you know, relationship issues. A couple people have been delayed in coming to sesshin because of the storm we had the other night. So, you know, there's lots of things to worry about in that way. But I also think that it's so easy for us to lose confidence in ourselves, you know, and I think our default position is often to have a lack of confidence about ourselves, you know. It's especially true though with beginners, right? Beginners are the people who come to sesshin for the first time. You know, around day two, a lot of people express skepticism about the possibility of this whole thing being successful. Right? You know, so it's very common on day two of sesshin to have people say, you know, I don't know if I'm doing the right thing. You know, I don't know if I'm if this was a good idea to come to sesshin. You know, they express doubts, not, you know, it's not just about Zen or Buddhist practice, it's really, you know, self-doubts also, you know, and I can tell you, I can't tell you how many times this happens. It's like, almost like it's day two. This is what all the conversations are going to be like. You know, people come into the Dokusan room and they're usually they may not say, you know, Zen is a bunch of crap, or, you know, they'll say, you know, I'll never, you know, or I don't have the answer to my koan, I know this, right? And it's just like clockwork. So often people will come into the Dokusan room with that preamble. They'll say, you know, I don't have anything. Things are really, you know, in fact, you know, when I first started teaching Zen, I trained with two teachers. One was a man named Takabayashi Genki Roshi. And he was a wonderful teacher. And then I trained with Kangan Gleb Roshi, who recently died. And he was also wonderful, wonderful person. And I can remember, you know, in both cases, having these experiences myself, where I went in to see the teacher, and I could barely open my mouth. I thought, this is such a hopeless, such a hopeless enterprise. And so beginners, you know, and experienced people, you know, all feel the same way around day two. They feel like, there's no way I'm going to answer this koan. I'm wasting my time. And then it's so often the case that what comes out of their mouth next is like perfect. It's like perfect. And this happened this morning with a couple people. You know, they gave me a long preamble about their inability to work with the koan, or how I can never do koans. And then they told me the response to the koan was so wonderfully right on target. You know, I'm not surprised when that happens. It's quite common. You know, people don't trust themselves, and they don't believe that they even have, a lot of the time, even have Buddha nature, right? And I've seen again and again how there's a kind of conflict going on in people who come to Zen. It's like you almost come to Zen practice and come to Sesshin. It's almost like you're saying, I know I can't do this, but maybe there's a chance I can do it. And what I think is really happening when people decide to come to Sesshin is that they have kind of like a split personality. You know, we have kind of a split personality. We live in an ordinary self, which is, you know, curt, and it was born in such a year, and you know, in that mentality, we feel, you know, basically more or less powerless to change almost anything about our life, actually. You know, we spend so much time in that place that it becomes difficult to imagine any other mode of existence. And I think most people really only know that life. Right, you know, so in Zen we say the small self, right? Most people only know that life. And you know, I think we all have had moments of insight. You know, even if we don't practice Zen, people have moments where they feel a little bit outside of themselves, a little bit bigger experience of the world. But I think the ordinary life of a person in our society is very much of how does he put it? He says, like a monkey in a cage, right? We're like a monkey in a cage. And I think what happens in growing up is that we become reconciled to life in the cage, right? And we become so reconciled to life in the cage that we don't believe that there is an out of the cage. There is an existence out of the cage. But all the same, I think that there's something that happens, you know, something that it prompts us all the same. Maybe it's just desperation sometime. I think in my case, it was really just, you know, kind of like desperation. You know, there must be something more to life than this. And I remember going in to sit with a Genki Roshi for the first time and having no idea what I was doing and not being particularly successful. But something powerfully motivated me, you know, to do this. And I didn't know what it was. Probably everybody in this room has had this same experience to some degree where, you know, what is enlightenment? You know, you read books on Zen, you read, what is enlightenment? You know, unless you've had an enlightenment experience, nobody really knows what enlightenment is, right? So what are you looking for? And I think what you're looking for is a way out of the cage, right? And the cage could be comfortable, you know, it could be reasonably a nice place to stay and it can be diverting. But I think that we all experience our lives sometimes as very limiting. And even though we don't know what we're looking for, something inside of us wants to have a bigger life, right? So, you know, people start doing Zen practice, but it's always with, I think, a kind of divided mind or ambivalent mind, right? It's like there's a part of us always saying, this is never going to work out. You know, people see, you see pictures of the Dalai Lama. Looking on Facebook, and there'll be something, the Dalai Lama making some kind of presentation in public. And people think, you know, people who believe that the Dalai Lama is enlightened will be willing to say, oh, the Dalai Lama is enlightened. I believe that. But then, you know, they think, well, but that could never be me, right? I mean, I'm a monkey in a cage. And I think that mentality is, underneath the ordinary mindset, there's a kind of fatalism, right? It's like I've gotten used to my little world, and I'm sort of adjusted to that. I'm sort of adjusted or reconciled to that. But all the same, there's a pull in the other direction, right? Where you know, there's a hope upon hope, right? That there's something bigger than that, that life in the cage, right? And yet, you know, at first you have no evidence at all that such a thing exists, except maybe, you know, the testimony of the Dalai Lama but I think a Zen teacher's job is to sort of say, well, but why not give it a try? Why not see if there is something outside the cage and trying to entice you, right? So the Dalai Lama wears these wonderful robes. They're ochre robes. I really love the, the blue robes are okay. The Zen robes are okay. But the Tibetan robes are just so beautiful, right? They're beautiful colors and it's enticing, right? If you come to our sesshin, you see Manjushri, beautiful Nepalese Manjushri statue and candle. And all of this is really kind of like enticement. It's like saying, you know, I know you don't believe you can wake up. I know you don't believe that such a thing is even possible. But somewhere inside you, there's this voice saying, is it possible that I could wake up? Is it, there's like something inside you is speaking to you, and it's hard to hear it because so much of your life experience has told you that is impossible, right? I worry about this a lot because, you know, in our in Buddhism today, there's this whole movement called secular Buddhism. And if you're a proponent of secular Buddhism, forgive me, I don't want to step on any toes, but you know, what secular Buddhism is really saying is that there isn't anything other than the cage, basically life in the cage, but you can use Buddhist techniques to improve life in the cage, right? So you know, basically if you have stress, you can do some meditation to reduce your stress. And if you're not a patient person, you can practice, say, mindfulness, or you could do loving kindness meditation. See, and so you know, basically in America today, lots of people do mindfulness meditation in this spirit of like making life in the cage a little better. But I feel that's unfortunate in a lot of ways. Because you know what's really most important, as far as I'm concerned, is getting out of the cage, and I, as I say, a lot of people in our culture don't really believe there is an outside of the cage, you know. But when people start practicing Zen, they begin to, you know, like I would say, believe in the possibility of something outside the cage. It's like there's a voice inside you that almost like remembers life out. Forgive me, but it's like there's a voice inside you, there's a part of you that remembers life outside of the cage, right? And you know, even though there's very little evidence for the belief in life outside of the cage, something motivates you to come to here, to Zen, to come to Sesshin in particular, because you know, Sesshin is so important to Zen practice. And, you know, there's, it's such a crazy thing to do, right? I mean, we're getting up at 4:30 in the morning. We're going to bed at 10:30 at night. And we're meditating for 8 or 9 hours a day. And, you know, all of this is done in the absence of any certainty, you know, any certainty about the outcome. There are stories about all of these people in the Zen world in ancient China, right, who have been practicing for like 20 years and they haven't had Daikensho, or 30 years. There's a couple koans where there are these very senior monks who haven't wakened up, and they finally have a breakthrough. One famous monk quit the temple. He went away. He became a gardener. He said, you know, Buddhism is a scam. It's a fraud. And he became a gardener, and he was working in the garden one day. He'd been meditating for 30 years or something. And he was raking, his rake caught a piece of roof tile, broken roof tile. And the roof tile hit a piece of bamboo. And when he heard that, he had his Daikensho. And you know, the story is so encouraging, because many people practice for a long time without having quote unquote Daikensho. But I find it so interesting that he kept going for 30 years. It's like, what was it that induced him to go for 30 years? And as I say, I think a Zen teacher's job is to try to get people to believe, just give it a try, right? Just give it a try, you know. There's no evidence, very little in our culture encourages us to believe that there's something outside of the cage. But all the same, just listen to that voice. And when people if people just listen to that voice, it becomes possible to step out of the cage. But it's kind of like a shot in the dark at first, right? In fact, it's always a shot in the dark. So all of this is, believe it or not, part of this koan, though you'd never guess. A monk asked Umon, what is the pure body of the Buddha? See. And you know, this is like Gyoshe's Mu. What is the essence of Buddhism? And he says, emptiness. You know, what is it? Emptiness. And here he's saying, what is enlightenment like? And he says, it's like a fence around a flower garden. So, you know, clearly enlightenment is not a fence around a flower garden. So, you know, basically, this is like the archetypal Zen koan, because it's asking you to make contact with that memory or that part of yourself that believes that there's something outside the cage, right? And if you start trusting that, you know, it's amazing what can happen, right? On day two of Sesshin, as I was saying, you know, people typically come to Sesshin thinking, well, I'll give it a try. You know, maybe I'll have enlightenment. And then by the end of the first day, you know, your legs hurt so much, you're so tired, you think, well, forget about enlightenment. You know, I just don't know if I want to stay here, right? You know, so, you know, they get up and they come in to Dokusan, and you know, so often the second day is like a litany of complaints about the, you know, I'll never do this, blah blah blah. And I myself did that many times, but then, you know, the most amazing thing happens is people so often give the right answer, right? You know, they don't even know it's the right answer. They just give the right answer. And sometimes it's like really beautiful answer. Somebody will come in and they will say something, and it's just, my heart will be pounding in my chest because it's such a deep engagement with their true nature. And they don't see it yet, right? They don't see it, but they're in contact with it. They're already, you could say, it's like the last to know is your small mind, right? It's the big mind is already activated, and people come in and the little mind is going, this is impossible. This is never going to work. This is bullshit. How could this possibly be true? And at the same time, already the big mind is speaking, in maybe not being heard by the person himself or the person herself. And I've gotten used to this. When I first started teaching Zen, Jim was actually around at that time, and Jaru. I remember we originally started doing sesshins at my house because we would only have four or five people coming to sesshin, maybe six, something like that, or seven. And we would just have it at my house. And the first time or second time I did Dokusan, I was just astounded because it was like, you know, this is my first or second sesshin. I've gone to all this trouble to set this up. I had my two wonderful teachers as my model, and people were coming in on day two of sesshin and saying things like, oh, I said, how's it going? They go, oh, terrible. You know, everything's going wrong. You know, it was just person after person. How's it going? Terrible. Oh, this is awful. You know, I may leave, you know, what am I doing wrong? And then, you know, day three or day four, the same people would come in, and they'd come into the Dokusan Ron, and I'm bracing for them to say, I'm out of here, you know, or, you know, forget it, you know. And instead, I'll say, how is it? And they'll go, oh, wonderful, wonderful, you know. So there's this transformation people experience, right, in sesshin. Everybody who's here knows that. I think we've all gone through this. But as a teacher, you know, I watch this process happening where, you know, for me too, for everybody, I think the first day of sesshin, and sometimes it can be the second day of sesshin, is just this tremendous, sort of almost like a conflict, between these two parts of our minds, right? It's like, you know, I can remember so many sesshins where when I would come to sesshin, most of the first day was spent just working through my negativity, just working through my negativity. And it wouldn't be just like, this is bullshit. It would be like, you know, such a deep, so many deep fears and inconfidence, you know, and anxieties and worries, right? It wouldn't just be about Zen. But you know, if you had asked me before I came to sesshin, you know, what kind of person are you? Are you I'd say, oh, reasonably confident. When I would come to sesshin around day two, I would just, a lot of day, the early part of sesshin is like coming face to face with all of these self-doubts and this insecurity and deep fears, right? Maybe this hasn't happened to you. But you know, these first few days are like, you know, people all have like these karmic residues, you could say, stored up, right? Where, you know, these very, very basic experiences of like abandonment or betrayal or being not heard, you know, all of that is under the surface of day one practice. And it expresses itself as a lot of, you know, sometimes real inner turmoil. You know, people may not be fully aware of it, but there's always, I can remember so many sesshins where the early part of the sesshin was when I wasn't just struggling with pain in my legs. Underneath that, there's this, you know, these fears would come out and these doubts, you know. And around day three of sesshin, it would be like all of a sudden, it was like I entered a different mental space, yeah? It's like that, I still sort of go through this process even now because we all have karma, we're all human beings. But, you know, it's like all of a sudden there's like a switch, a change in your consciousness. And you're in this place that's so open. And it has other characteristics too. You know, for me, when I begin to enter that place, when I entered that alternate space, first of all, it's like all of that stuff somehow no longer matters. It's like, okay, I may get, you know, I may get a promotion and I may not, and I may get this and I may not. But suddenly all of that seems very tiny and unimportant. And it's like you go to this place that's, for me, the way I experience it is like going to a place that's, you know, like ancient. Oh, I remember going to the Anasazi ruins in Chaco Canyon. I don't know if you've ever seen pictures of this, but it's this adobe house built under a cliff. And I remember the first time I went there, it was such an uncanny experience because it seemed like so ancient, right? And just like ancient and mysterious and so on. And, you know, when I'm in day three, I'm sort of moving into a place mentally that's like that. It's like, you know, almost like I feel like, oh, this is timeless, you know? And I've been here before, but when, you know, those kinds of experiences. So I can sort of feel when I'm shifting into that other mindset. And so there's like day one and day two are sort of like this battle between my doubts and my hopes. And, you know, around day three, there's like this shift and suddenly you're entering this and you know, this will happen to everybody if they stay at sesshin and they continue to practice. But when you get into that other mindset, it's like the view from the mountaintop, right? It's like these things that seem so troubling and frightening, all of these doubts, all of this stuff just seems to be unimportant. And it's like your sense of time changes. You know, suddenly you realize, you know, to put it metaphorically, I have lived many lives and will live many lives. But right now there's just this, you know, and this is open in all directions, right? So you may not express it that way, you know. Everybody who goes to that place, I think, experiences it a little differently, right? So when Uman is describing it, right, a monk asked Uman, what is that place that you go to on day 3 of Sesshin where all of your inner turmoil suddenly goes away? And, you know, you're up at 10,000, you're up at 14,000 feet looking out over the valley. And what is that like for you? And Uman says, it's like a fence around a flower garden. You know, for me, it feels like going to some ancient building where I see, you know, who built this? You know, this is so ancient. You know, the Buddha actually said that he taught, I teach an ancient way. In other words, you know, my way goes back to the beginning of time, basically, is what he said. This ain't the most ancient way, you know. It's like long before all of this, you know, this path was here. That's how he put it. My first teacher, Genki Roshi, said that on day 3, he would, just before he made this shift from his little mind into his big mind, he said he would be like everybody else, you know, struggling with his discomfort, his fatigue, his, you know, sense of his personal limits, whatever, you know, this will never work out, you know. And then he said, you know, he would have a dream where he would see himself as a little monk in his dream. He'd see himself as a little monk. My first teacher was a boy monk. His father and mother were killed in the war, and he was adopted in a Zen monastery, and that's where he grew up. And he said he'd see himself as a little monk, and then he'd wake up. And he said, and I, you know, he would be in this different place. And he said, then I would go in and answer my koan. And I asked him, how many koans, what's the most number of koans you have answered in one session? And he said, oh, I think I did 10 once or something. So it works, you know. Everybody experiences this transition, you know. It's the same transition for everybody, but we all dress it up in our own way. We all have like our own, you know, the basic structure of the mind is the same for everybody, in my opinion. But, you know, we all, we use our imaginations to make it meaningful to us. And we all do that a little differently. So, you know, for you, the third day of Sesshin may be, you know, maybe like you get up in the morning and you're sitting on the cushion all the morning sit, and you're thinking about, so, you know, one of my friends, when he goes through this transition, he has these dreams of like clear water, you know, clear water. Just like he'll see a stream, it'll be day 3 of Sesshin, he's sitting there, and all of a sudden, as he's between sleep and waking, there'll be like a little dream, and he'll just see this clear water, and he could see down into the stones. You know, that's how his mind puts clothes on the experience. He sees it as pure water flowing, you know, this pristine stream flowing over stones, and I experience it as visiting the Anasazi ruins at Chaco Canyon. And another friend of mine, also a very deeply awakened person, said when he was a little kid, he had a blanket made out of wool with a velvet liner. And when he was a little kid, he used to suck his thumb, and he would put the, he would go to sleep with this velvet liner pressed against his face of the wool blanket. And you know, when he was moving into day three mentality, big mind, from little mind into big mind, he'd like remember this, you know, every time it would pop up in his head. So none of this may happen to you. That's okay. Don't worry if you don't have any dreams of yourself as a young monk or anything like that. But we all go through this transition where we're all brought here by some mysterious force inside ourselves that says pursue this even though we don't know what it is. And, you know, around this time, around the end of day two and the beginning of day three, there is some, it's like a light goes on in your head and suddenly everything has changed. And you keep going through that process no matter how long you practice. But, you know, it gets deeper and deeper, I would say. And you learn to trust yourself more, right? You learn to trust your big mind more. All of our problems are caused by not trusting our big mind, right? And this koan is about that process and learning how to trust. Hengo's introduction. When one is enlightened and enjoys perfect freedom of mind in ordinary life, one is like a tiger that commands its mountain retreat. If one is not enlightened and drifts about in affairs of the world, one is like a monkey in a cage. If you want to know Buddha nature, you must pay attention to time and causation. If you aspire to the condition of pure gold that has been refined 100 times over, you must be shaped in the teacher's forge. What does that mean? It means that every time you go through this, you know, I always say to people, Sesshin is so important because, you know, it's the process you go through. So daily practice is indispensable. If you don't practice and then you come to Sesshin, that's like never going for a walk and trying to run a marathon. But, you know, it's the process of going through Sesshin that's so important. You know, day one, day two, and then there's this shift. And every time you go through that shift, right, it's like at first, 99% of yourself is small mind. And 1% of it is big mind, maybe. But if you keep practicing Zen and you keep coming to Sesshin, it's like that proportion. It's like gradually, you know, like 60% of your mental life is little mind and 40% is big mind. But gradually, those change places, right? It's like you don't stop living in the little mind world, but your default awareness becomes that day three big mind. It becomes the fence around the garden, right? Because that it becomes the your trip to the Anasazi ruins. It becomes whatever however your mind clothes it, right? So being shaped in the teacher's forge means going through this process many times, right? And as you do that, you're also cleaning up your karma. You're every time you go through all that entangling stuff on day one or day two of Sesshin, you're purifying your body, mind, and heart. So I want to ask you this, how would one identify the person who has mastered the way of the absolute? Okay, main subject. A monk asked Umon, what is the pure body of the Buddha? Umon said, Kaya Kuran, the fence around a flower garden. Now the monk said, how about if I understand it like that? Now that's an interesting question. He said, well, will I understand it the same way? And Umon responds cryptically. He says, the golden-haired lion. A golden-haired lion actually in this literature means it's like a compliment. So if somebody's really sitting well, a teacher might say, he's a golden-haired lion. In other words, or she's a golden-haired lion. See, very, very, so the student already sees the problem, right? You know, if I say, when I enter day three of Sesshin, I feel like I've gone back to Chaco Canyon, and you want to have that experience and you try to visualize Chaco Canyon, that doesn't work. You know, your transition is going to, I have never dreamed of myself as a kid the way Genki Roshi did. So, you know, each of us has to encounter our big mind in the same way, but we're all, I mean, in a different way, but it's the same big mind. And it's really the same path. So all of you are doing a wonderful job. Everybody's sitting so deeply, and just keep up the good work. You're all golden-haired lions. So thank you.